Hello, this is Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, August 20th, 2026. There's a photo on the front page with the headline, Emptying the Nest, and the caption, Michael D'Amico left helps younger brother John unload luggage from the car during their move-in day Wednesday outside Scott Hall on the University of Illinois campus in Champaign. Their parents, Mike and Beth, said the feelings are bittersweet because John is the last child to be sent off to college. Move-in week at the U of I began Sunday and continues through the coming Sunday. Tiny home community aims to open it in November. And there's a small photo with the caption, Construction continues on Urbana's Hope Village, a project that will provide permanent supportive housing to homeless, medically fragile individuals. Plan is for residents to move in phases. A new community of tiny homes for medically fragile homeless individuals could move its first residents in yet this year. We're shooting for November 15th, said Drew Martin, executive director of Hope Village. So we'll have substantial construction done at the facility by mid to late September, and substantial meaning that we'll be able to have the first five or six units completed by grand opening or ribbon cutting, which is going to be October 20th. Hope Village is under construction on land just south of Federal Drive in Urbana. Martin said the plan is to move residents in phases, with about six each month until all 24 homes are filled with one resident each. The project has been in the works since at least late 2022. Partners include Carl Health, Champaign County Healthcare Consumers, and the University of Illinois. The work has received funding from the State of Illinois, the City of Urbana, the Local Housing and Homeless Innovations Grant Program, and Housing Authority of Champaign County. In addition to permanent supportive housing, Hope Village residents will be connected with health care, case management, and other supportive services through partnerships with local providers, officials say. The cost of energy will be built into a resident's rent, which will be limited to about 30% of their income, Martin said. Additional expenses such as food, cable TV, and internet will not be included in the figure. As for how long residents might be in Hope Village, Martin said that this is not transitional living and an individual can live there until they die. However, he added that the program will provide options for those who wish to leave the community once their medical conditions have improved. There are far more than 24 people who are chronically homeless and medically fragile in our area, he said, so we want to definitely make it viable for people to move to other appropriate living. We assume that some people, once they're stabilized, will want to get reconnected with family. Martin's career includes experience in healthcare, housing stability, health equality, health equity, managed care, and community development. Hope Village officials said he most recently served as Director of Network and Strategic Partnerships for the Well-Being and Equity in the World Institute. Before that, Martin was Director of Growth for the Community and State Division of United Healthcare, where he led strategic initiatives supporting large-scale homelessness prevention efforts within managed care, he said. He also previously served as a senior manager with the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, led community development and social service initiatives in the Chicagoland area, and has served on the boards for Carl Foundation Hospitals East Region, Salt and Light Ministries, and Health Alliance. Hope Village is about creating a place where people can be housed, supported, and treated with dignity, Martin said. For residents who have experienced homelessness while managing complex health challenges, stability can change everything. His education includes a master's degree in healthcare delivery science from Dartmouth College and a master's in public administration from DePaul University. Drew brings the right combination of healthcare systems experience, community development leadership, and commitment to health equity, said Marty Smith, chair of Hope Village's board. As Hope Village moves closer to welcoming residents, his leadership will be important in helping us build a strong foundation for the family this community is designed to serve. Prairie Dragon Paddlers. Local breast cancer survivors set sail for France. Next week, breast cancer survivors from East Central Illinois will trade the familiar waters of Homer Lake for the shores of Lac de Bourget in the French Alps, joining thousands of dragon boat paddlers from around the world for a week-long celebration of survivorship. The Prairie Dragon Paddlers, Illinois' first breast cancer survivor dragon boat team, will travel to Isle-Aban, France for the 2026 Participatory Dragon Boat Festival, which starts Monday. The event is expected to bring about 4,500 participants from 320 teams representing 37 countries. For the local nonprofit, the trip is more than an international sporting event. It is an event. It is an opportunity for women who have experienced breast cancer from diagnosis and treatment through recovery to come together in camaraderie. It really does bring a lot of empowerment back to you when you've been going through treatment and chemotherapy, which can be really harsh on your body, said Vanessa Fari, the team's executive director. It's a way to kind of get yourself back. The local team welcomed the public to Homer Lake earlier this month for its annual Friends and Family Day, giving visitors a chance to experience the sport that has become central to the group's mission. The women practice twice a week during their May to September season and compete in breast cancer survivor divisions at dragon boat races around the Midwest. Earlier this summer, the team won gold in both the 200-meter and 500-meter races at the Chicago Dragon Boat Festival. But the trip to France will offer something different. Held every 3 to 4 years by the International Breast Cancer Paddlers Commission, the week-long celebration brings together women from around the world without the competitive focus of a typical race. This year marks the first time the international gathering will be held in France. That sense of global community is familiar to board president Stephanie Harpst, a prairie dragon paddler since the nonprofit's earliest days. She traveled to New Zealand in 2023 with other breast cancer paddlers and recalled seeing thousands of survivors from around the world participate in a parade of nations. Harpst was approaching 9 years past her breast cancer diagnosis at the time and said she has become accustomed to putting family and other responsibilities before herself. Joining the team changed that. It's one of the best decisions she says she has ever made for herself, adding that the sport gave her life back. Now she will be among the entourage traveling to France. The global movement traces back to 1996, when Canadian doctor and researcher Don McKenzie challenged the long-held medical belief that women undergoing breast cancer treatment should avoid strenuous upper body exercise. He launched a study placing 20 breast cancer survivors in a traditional Chinese dragon boat, hypothesizing that the repetitive paddling motion would aid physical recovery and lymphatic drainage. His research helped fuel a movement that has since spread around the world, with breast cancer survivor dragon boat teams forming across dozens of countries. Kelly Bradham, a registered nurse and social worker who founded the Prairie Dragon Paddlers, was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2012. In an earnest effort to help other women regain strength and find support after treatment, she began researching dragon boating. She eventually traveled to the Pacific Northwest to meet one of the pioneering U.S. teams. "They invited me in the boat, and I didn't paddle, but they were kind to me," Bradham said. "They brought me to their team dinner at the end of the race, and they really encouraged me to get a team started here." Bradham spent about 2 years researching how to establish a team in East Central Illinois before the nonprofit was founded in 2015. Today, the team has about 60 members from Champaign-Urbana and surrounding communities. Some are years past the end of their treatment, while others are still undergoing treatment. Lori Pearson of Champaign joined the team about a year ago after her own breast cancer diagnosis. "I needed people to be around that knew what I was going through," Pearson said. "That peer support is one of the reasons the organization wants to make the team accessible to more women in East Central Illinois. The Paddlers use word of mouth, social media, educational events, and connections with health care providers to reach potential members. Members also advocate for mammograms and early detection and encourage women to develop survivorship plans after treatment. The organization also established the Prairie Dragon Paddlers Breast Cancer Research Fund at the University of Illinois to support research. The International Festival offers the women something that cannot be replicated at home, the chance to see just how large their community has become. Fari said dragon boating can begin as an unusual way for a breast cancer survivor to exercise, but the relationships formed through the sport often become just as important as the paddling itself. "We're very, very fortunate," Fari said. "It's really a camaraderie kind of group." Teacher of the Week, Laura Soto Rodriguez, Special Education, Yankee Ridge Elementary, Urbana. Signs of success. After beginning her career teaching preschool and elementary school in Columbia for 8 years, Laura Soto Rodriguez moved to the U.S. 5 years ago and began teaching special education. When she began at Yankee Ridge Elementary School in Urbana 2 years ago, she found an outlet for her skills and bilingual background, and she's quickly made an impact on her students and fellow staff. "I find my work important because I believe that every child has the right to access a meaningful and high-quality education, regardless of their abilities, language, background, or individual challenges. Every student deserves to feel included, respected, supported, and capable of learning. My work is important because I can help remove some of the barriers that may prevent students from fully participating in school. Sometimes this means adapting an activity, teaching a skill in a different way, providing emotional support, or helping a student communicate a basic need. These actions may seem small, but they can make an important difference in a child's daily life. I became a teacher because I strongly believe in the power of education to create opportunities and help individuals and communities grow. Education can open doors, change a person's future, and give children the tools they need to understand themselves and the world around them. As I learned more about special education, I discovered another important part of teaching that I had not fully understood before. Special education requires flexibility, patience, creativity, consistency, teamwork, and a great deal of love. It has taught me that students may learn or communicate in different ways, but every student is capable of making progress when they receive the right support. Being a special education teacher has also helped me understand that success does not look the same for every child. For one student, success may be completing an academic activity. For another, it may be communicating a need, following a routine, trying something new, or participating with classmates. I feel honored to support students through these important moments. My favorite lesson is incorporating sign language into my lessons so that students can begin communicating their needs, feelings, and choices. Every time a student independently uses one of these signs, I feel they have taken an important step toward greater communication and independence. My most fulfilling moments on the job are when I see my students making progress. In special education, every small step is important and deserves to be celebrated. Seeing students develop new skills, become more independent, or communicate in a new way makes my work especially rewarding. I enjoy celebrating moments such as when a student communicates independently, completes a task with less assistance, participates in a group activity, learns a classroom routine, or successfully manages a difficult transition. These achievements remind me that patience, consistency, and teamwork can make a meaningful difference. I can also feel fulfilled when students begin to recognize their own abilities. Seeing a student become more confident, proud, or willing to try again is one of the best parts of my job. Their progress motivates me to continue learning and finding new ways to support them. I keep students engaged by incorporating their interests, preferences, and strengths into my lesson. Every student is different, so I take time to observe what motivates them. When I connect a lesson to something a student already enjoys, the activity becomes more meaningful and inviting. For example, I may use a favorite toy to practice requesting, incorporate songs into a transition, or use preferred images and objects during an academic lesson. I also try to provide students with choices and opportunities to participate in different ways. I believe students are more engaged when they feel safe, understood, and successful. Building a positive and trusting relationship with each student is an essential part of keeping them motivated to learn. I'm also passionate about cooking and painting. Cooking allows me to be creative while also staying connected to my family and my Colombian culture. I enjoy preparing meals that bring people together and sharing traditional foods with my children. Painting is another activity that helps me relax and express my creativity. Both cooking and painting require patience and attention to detail, which are also qualities that are important in my work as a teacher. Most importantly, I am passionate about spending meaningful time with my family. They are an important source of support and inspiration in my life. When it comes to my own favorite teacher, I remember my high school English teacher in Colombia with great affection. She supported us not only academically, but also personally. She genuinely cared about our well-being and made us feel that we were important. Her example showed me that teaching is about supporting the whole student, not only their academic development. If I weren't a teacher, I would probably be a pediatrician. Medicine was another field that interested me when I was younger, especially because it would have allowed me to continue working with and helping children. I spent my summer with my family in Colombia. I love having the opportunity to spend quality time with my children, visit relatives, reconnect with loved ones, and enjoy the places, traditions, and foods that remind me of home. During the school year, life can become very busy, so summer gives us a time to slow down and create special memories together. Being with my family helps me recharge and return to school feeling refreshed, grateful, and ready for a new year. And we have Mike Hale's Records and Radio column, Explaining the Art of Picking Music for the Radio, Part 4. After a couple of detours, we're back to the most asked radio questions of my 57 years in the business. How do you decide what songs to play, and or why do you play certain songs but not others? But first, a quiz question. Ella Langley's current number one run on Billboard Hot 100 chart with Choosin' Texas, set to enter its 18th week at the top spot next week, pretty much ensures that she will have the top song of 2026. What are three songs ahead of Langley with the most weeks at number one in the 68-year history of the Hot 100? Carrying over from my last column, let's pick up the story from February 4, 1990. The first couple of weeks after the format change from K104 to Oldies 104, soon to be Oldies 92, was not for the faint of heart. I talked with hundreds of listeners who were upset that we changed their station of the past 12 years. Interestingly, after 2 weeks, those phone calls disappeared. By the end of February, radio listeners, many of them were not K104 partisans, told us they loved what we were doing. When the Sprig Arbitron rating book came out, we controlled the adult demos of ages 25 to 54 and 35 to 64, while WLRW dominated the 12 to 24 demos. Overall, across the U.S., we tied with a station in Panama City, Florida, for the highest average quarter-hour share of any oldies station in the country. In the oldies format, the first rating book is the easiest. I would spend the next 10 years answering the question, how do you keep an oldies station fresh when they aren't making any new oldies? When the end of the decade came along, we were one of the 10 highest-rated oldies stations in the country. Our team effort worked to thank these keys. We spent money on perceptual research and music testing. Music testing consisted of our research partner selecting 60 or so participants. A majority were KIO partisans. Some were LRW and HMS listeners were included in this survey panel. They came to a local hotel ballroom only knowing that a radio station wanted their opinions on music. Participants were fed appetizers and at the conclusion of the evening were paid cash for their time. The panel listened to several hundred short 8 to 12 second song hooks with an electronic dial in hand. They rated each song between 0 and 100. It didn't take too long for the panel to realize what station was conducting that test. After the conclusion of this test, Jeff Balding and I appeared from behind the curtain. We took advantage of hearing verbatim Champagne Radio feedback from the participants. You can see a sample page from the hundreds of breakouts available to me for making music decisions. Speaking of music, part of the secret sauce was that KIO was feature-driven every day from the noon flashback to the nightly Hall of Fame to the solid gold weekend. We found reasons to spotlight a cool song that didn't get played that often. Balding guided our outside marketing efforts with billboards, TV, direct mail, and more. We had plenty of contests, trips, cash, and more. WKIO was the only station that would have cash winners in the overnight hours. During those 10 years, at any given time, our personalities had a minimum of 400 different audio imaging pieces to work with, conveying the message that our music was awesome. Jerry Moorfield did a lion's share of those creations to keep us sounding fresh every day. I was a jingle fanatic, adding a new singing jingle package every 18 months. Oldies 92 was the only radio station in our area where every on-air personality, full and part-time, got their own name jingle. By far the number one key that made the format a success in keeping the music fresh for 10 years were the air personalities, Lee Marcus, Patty Good, Rob Stone, Luann Larson, Marty McKee, and a host of others were always on their A-game, enthusiastically selling our music product every day. In July 2000, at the culmination of the $7 million sale of WKIO to Saga, a record for an East Central Illinois station, I was off to a new adventure. WHMS was the lone adult contemporary station in the area. Making music decisions was a little easier since the volume of new music available was not as robust as it was in the 80s. After being in Oldies for 10 years, there were now so many different flavors of adult contemporary music. Mainstream in one lane, a rhythmic lane, a country lane, an alternative lane, a hot lane, etc. Marcus, Ryan, Arthur, and Allie Adams did a superb job of analyzing the available new product and making it work in CU within our gold-based music library. The neat thing in programming adult contemporary is that it's constantly evolving. It's a true fun format that gives us a lot of latitude. Sadly, just like the challenges of political polling in 2026, we can no longer get a quality sample for music tests, perceptual studies, or even ratings, most people have zero interest in participating. The good news is we have so many other tools like real-time media base and a host of other quality radio resources helping to guide decisions. As always, I appreciate your feedback along with topics to explore. Warren urges Illinois Dems to unite behind nominees. U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren urged Illinois Democrats on Wednesday to unite behind the party's nominees in the upcoming midterm elections so they can win control of Congress and block Republican President Donald Trump from advancing his agenda. And to show she was serious, she announced she is putting $500,000 into the party's coordinated campaign funds to elect Democrats to the U.S. House and Senate, plus another $100,000 to the Democratic National Committee to strengthen the party's internal infrastructure. It is time to stop the hand-wringing and to invest in a key part of our democratic infrastructure, Warren, Democrat Massachusetts, told an audience of more than 2,000 Democrats in Springfield. And I am asking others to join me and do the same. Warren was the keynote speaker at the Illinois Democratic County Chairs Association Brunch, an annual event that coincides with Governor's Day at the Illinois State Fair. The focus of this year's event was to celebrate Illinois retiring Senator Dick Durbin while also showcasing the party's slate of candidates in the November election. But Warren's speech came at the same time internal friction has been rising within the party as a new generation of young, left-leaning, and self-identified socialist candidates have been rising to prominence around the country. by defeating establishment-backed candidates in contested primaries. Just a day earlier, Angie Nixon, a little-known Florida state legislator and member of the Democratic Socialists of America, scored an upset victory of the more moderate establishment-backed candidate Alex Vindman to win that state's U.S. Senate primary. And earlier this month, Abdul El Sayed, a progressive candidate, edged out the more moderate U.S. Representative Haley Stevens to win Michigan's Senate primary. Warren, who is often identified with the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, but whose message is usually more populist than socialist, admitted she has often been critical of party leaders for meddling in competitive primaries. "I think it's wrong for the party to put a thumb on the scale when Democrats are choosing their nominee," she said. "I think it's wrong to line up with big money to drown out grassroots candidates. Wrong, and it weakens us. But I know our job now," she continued. "Democrats must win the Senate, and I'm 100% behind our Democratic nominees everywhere, and I'm 100% behind getting them the resources they need to win with. Leading Illinois Democrats this Wednesday, they remain confident of the party's chances in November." Local election info app now available for Apple devices. Android version not yet ready. The Champaign County Clerk's Office has introduced a new app to help voters access information about local elections. The free Champaign County Poll Tracker app is now available for Apple devices. An Android version will be available soon, officials said. More information is available at ccpolltrack.com. The Champaign County Clerk's Office has continued to prioritize modernizing election equipment and tools to help voters across the county, said County Clerk and Recorder Aaron Amons. The mobile app allows voters to have relevant and important election information right at their fingertips. The Clerk's Office previously considered developing an app in 2020, but the effort was hindered by the pandemic, officials said. Features of the app include election results, a list of candidates running in the current election, a map of polling locations along with estimated wait times for each, a map of ballot drop boxes, election news updates from the clerk's office, hyperlinks to other election-related resources, including forms on the clerk's website, ballot tracks, and the Champaign County voter registration portal. The app's privacy policy clarifies that it does not process voter registrations, ballots, or votes of any kind, and it is not a substitute for the clerk's own official systems or publications. Early voting in the November general election begins September 24th. Paxton Buckley Loda High School. Coral Boosters treasurer accused of embezzling $21,000. The treasurer of a fundraising group for Paxton Buckley Loda School's choral program was arrested for allegedly stealing $21,000 from his bank account. Tara L. Long, 44, of Paxton, was arrested by Paxton police on a charge of theft between $10,000 and $100,000, a Class II felony, and taken to the Ford County Jail. Coy Cornett said, Long has since been released from custody, according to jail staff. Formal charges had not yet been filed as of Wednesday in Ford County Circuit Court. State's Attorney Andrew Killian did not immediately respond to an email requesting comment. Cornett said his department was contacted around noon August 18th by school district administrators who reported fraudulent activity on the PBL Coral Boosters bank account. It was found that an estimated 60 unauthorized withdrawals, totaling $21,000, were made from the account between June 26th and August 17th, Cornett said. There were ATM withdrawals and Cash App money transfers, Cornett said. At 3:08 p.m. that same day, Paxton police met with Lang, who was subsequently arrested. This has been Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, August 20th, 2026. Please stay tuned for Part 2.